Hello, and welcome to this very special episode of Diabetes Dialogue, Technology, Therapeutics, and Real-World Perspectives. I am Diana Isaacs, joined by my co-host, Natalie Bellini. And I know I say a lot of episodes are special, but this one truly is because we are doing the top 10 countdown of 2023 Diabetes Dialogue episodes. This is going to be fast, like speed dating. So, Natalie, turning it to you for number 10.
So number 10 was automated insulin delivery news in October. And some of the things that we talked about was the Omnipod 5 app was FDA approved for use in the iPhone specifically. And we are expecting that launch in the first part of 2024. So that's really exciting news. People have been waiting for this. So the second thing we talked about in that episode was pregnancy and AID. And this is near and dear to both of our hearts because we both do pregnancy and diabetes, and we are using AID systems, which none of them are FDA approved during pregnancy, but we're using them. And data is starting to come out about the power to use it and helping each other in different clinics and what people are doing to get these AID systems to drive those glucoses down, fasting of less than 95, and whether none of the systems right now FDA approved that are available at this time have a target that low, and yet we're using them, and we're having to make decisions about is it okay to do that and have that fasting a little bit higher, but during the day have the numbers be more in range and those kinds of things. And the data looks good, right? Overall, the data looks pretty good. We use all the different brands, and that's where we are with it. I know you have something to say about this because I can see your eyebrows. Diana and I are friends, and I can see her go, "All right, I got something to say now, Natalie."
I just wanted to add related to that. Like, so it was the ADAPT study, which was done in the UK with the CAM APS. But that, I mean, that was pretty huge in the New England Journal of Medicine and really first randomized control trial using AID in pregnancy, showing great outcomes. We hope FDA approved systems will be. Come to us in the future. And then I also just want to say, I think in that episode too, we talked a little bit about now the Dexcom G7 integration with some of these pumps as well, with Omnipod 5 and with
But also,
Pilot.
that the CAM apps isn't available in the US. So we have
No,
to
it's
take
not.
that data and use it for what we have here, right? So there in the past, things got approved in the US first, and that is not true anymore. So things are changing. And so sometimes things get approved in the US first and sometimes they don't, right? So we're kind of looking at sister companies and to what's next and who's using what to do that. I think in 2024, fingers crossed, there'll be newer systems out, hopefully using loop algorithms and those kinds of things that will help us drive that pregnancy goal down and be available in the US.
Yeah, definitely. And then, yeah, just going back, Dexcom G7. So it's actually not yet with Omnipod 5, but we talked about iLet and then Tandem got the clearance, the approval, and those are now actually available. So that was great in
And we're
that one.
using them in practice every day now. And people are upgrading, and it's amazing. 10 years ago, you'd purchase an insulin pump, and that was your pump for the next 4 to 5 years. And now all of the pumps have an ability to upgrade the software and continue to use them, which has been such an amazing thing for the people pushing those buttons every day. It has made us not have to commit to one thing forever, which is really nice. And then there we also talked in that episode real quick about some 780G data, some real world evidence that continues to come out. So 780G was recently approved in the United States, but it's been used outside the US for a number of years now, and the data is phenomenal. Like country we were in, was it Barcelona when we saw the first data coming out, and you could touch on a country and see the time and range for everyone in the country itself. Amazing data coming out on the 780G, and we're excited to be using it more and more here.
Definitely. All right. I'm moving to episode number 9 because we said this would be speed dating or whatever, speed episoding. But episode 9 was actually our top episode was new guidelines, specifically the new ACE guidelines for diabetes for 2023, American Association of Clinical Endocrinology. I had the great fortune of being at the annual meeting when those were first presented and released back last May. And so the previous version before this one was from 2020. So it was really nice to see the whole algorithms updated and everything, and especially seeing the medication algorithm really being very much in line with, for example, the ADA. And so the whole kind of complication-centric algorithm for treating people with certain agents, if they have kidney disease or they have heart failure or cardiovascular disease. And one of the things that still really stands out to me is about their separate pathway for stroke, and specifically using, for example, pioglitazone or a GLP-1 agonist, which do have shown benefits for people with previous strokes. So that was really great to see. And of course, they have a whole other host of great kind of tools and resources. They have a whole profile of the different anti-hyperglycemic medications. So it's a great resource to kind of see the different characteristics of the different agents. They also had one for the weight loss medications. Of course, tirzepatide wasn't FDA approved yet at the time, but they have all of the others. They also had one on vaccines. And I think it's just great to see such a comprehensive tool available. And also, of course, more recently now, our ADA standards of care for 2024 also were updated. And I think in my mind, they complement each other very well. There's definitely way more similarities than differences. And I think both are great tools to refer to when trying to kind of determine management and have as a great clinical resource.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So let's do number 8. What Medicare drug price negotiations mean for diabetes? So, you know, we are now seeing the Medicare negotiations. There were a list of drugs that are under the discussion of, okay, we should be negotiating prices for the diabetes drugs on the Medicare negotiation list included empagliflozin, sitagliptin, dapagliflozin, and a Novo Nordisk specific insulin aspart products. So if you think about it, that was a lot of medication specific to diabetes in these drug negotiation list drugs. And the one I'm going to talk about and highlight is insulin, because now there is an agreement that all insulins for people with diabetes who have Medicare cost $35 a month. And that has changed our practice. It has changed what we're able to do, because most people can find a way to afford that. And so there we are having much less discussion around how do I do this? What do I do? And much more about how much can I take and when can I do it? And I think that also coupled with CGM coverage for people using even one injection a day has truly changed our Medicare patient ability to manage diabetes using insulin a whole lot better. But there are some other diabetes drugs. There was a top 10 list that was published of, okay, what else is on there? One of the SGLT2s is on there. Looking at the cost of, wait a minute, if we can use these drugs to treat heart failure and reduce the risk of kidney disease and do all these things, but no one can afford it, then what? So I think that there is going to be more to come around this, but I really would like sit back and just love the fact that the insulin is now covered at $35 and CGM is now covered with one injection a day, and really look at that side of the benefits of what's happened in 2023.
I guess I'm not surprised this was a top viewed episode, because there's so much to say on this, on the whole cost of the medications and everything. And especially with what we're seeing right now with like copycat GLP-1s. I mean, a GLP-1 wasn't even on the list, right? But we're seeing now like copycat versions get into the marketplace. And I don't know, it's just, it'll be interesting how that kind of disrupts everything. It could disrupt research innovation. We'll see the implications of it, but it'll take several years to actually really come to fruition anyway, these new negotiations. So stay tuned, I guess. All right, number 7. So step 7 was actually semaglutide and the STEP-HFpEF clinical trial. I'm also going to use this as an opportunity to talk about SELECT, because we also talked about that one. So this was a big year for incretins, a big year for semaglutide. And so this was studied in people without diabetes that had heart failure with preserved ejection fraction showing benefit. And this was a large, or I don't know, it was like a middle-sized randomized controlled trial. It was published in New England Journal of Medicine. And I think quite significant because GLP-1s have not been associated as heart failure drugs before. That's been the SGLT2 inhibitors. Like you look at the algorithms, heart failure, you're going to use an SGLT2 inhibitor. They have the most robust evidence for both preserved and reduced ejection fraction. But what I think is happening here is that the weight loss through the mechanism of weight loss, which we know very, very effective, turns out that helps a lot of comorbid conditions, including those with heart failure, with preserved ejection fraction. So that was really very unique. I think very, very exciting to see that. And we'll see what happens in terms of, we don't have an FDA approved indication for that right now, but who knows, we'll see what happens in the future. And then the other thing, SELECT, I mean, SELECT was really, really a very pivotal landmark clinical trial. The first time an obesity agent showed a reduction in cardiovascular disease of 20% reduction, actually, in people with overweight or obesity with pre-existing cardiovascular disease. And that, to me, is everything. And I think that's really changes the whole way that we treat that we treat obesity, because it's not some, oh, I just want to shed weight to look better. This is like a cardiovascular disease risk factor that we're now reducing by using these agents. And so I think that's going to be hugely significant. Of course, we had talked about in the episode, it was only done in people with established cardiovascular disease. So we can't say at this time that someone without cardiovascular disease, that it also lowers their risk. I'm sure we can hypothesize if someone's high risk, what we think would happen, but we don't know. That's how it was studied. But very, I think just very exciting all around. Big year for semaglutide.
So episode 6, Diabetes Dialogue, was covering the Dexcom G7 and the future of CGM with Jake Leach when we were actually at ATTD. And one of the big things was G7 was just approved and right after global launch. So Dexcom did this amazing global launch of G7, and G7 was a big change from G6 with Dexcom. It removed the removable 90-day transmitter. It's once one patch and done, pull it off. So there has been a lot of improvements in the operability of the sensor itself. CMS approved it immediately, which means the Center for Medicare covered it right away. And then also big, big, big news again in my heart and your heart is that indication for pregnancy. Before this was the indication for pregnancy, which we had all been waiting for. So that's the roundup of the episode 6, which was such an exciting thing at the time.
Definitely. Yeah. Big year. And speaking of that, let me go to episode 5 right now, which was an update about the introduction of Tandem Mobi, as well as WellDoc's Blue Star platform for the Tempo Smart button. And so that, I mean, in terms of the Mobi, we were so excited. I mean, we're still really excited about it. We expect in early 2024 for that to kind of roll out to the masses. But getting to see that the Tandem Control IQ would be able to be offered on a much smaller pump. It's not quite a tubeless pump, but you have the option to have only 5 inches of tubing. And there's one button on the pump that you can use to bolus, but otherwise everything is really controlled from the phone app. And that's where you can program the settings, and that's where usually a person's going to be bolusing from. And so they never really have to take out their pump. They can tape it onto their body. They can just keep it for those that want to really keep it more discreet. They don't have to kind of keep pulling it out with all their tubing and all that stuff. They can do everything from the phone. It is smaller. It holds 200 units of insulin instead of the current t:slim, which holds 300 units. And so it's just exciting to see another option. And then of course that will be available with both Dexcom G6 and Dexcom G7, as well as we expect future Libre integration into that as well. And then on the other side, we do spend a lot of time talking about insulin pumps and automated insulin delivery. The reality is that probably more than half of people on multiple administrations of insulin are actually using insulin pens or insulin vials. And for those, it's also nice to be able to introduce technology. And that's where smart pens and pen caps have been really exciting. And so we have the Tempo smart button, which goes on to Tempo insulin pens to track insulin dosing. But in this particular episode, we were very excited about WellDoc's Blue Start platform gaining FDA approval, because this is the platform that actually works with the Tempo button. And this will allow for the bolus calculator to be implemented. And so I think on one hand, yes, it's great to be able to track. That's kind of one step of these smart devices, but to be able to actually calculate how much to take. And it doesn't mean someone needs to do strict carbohydrate counting. They can be doing meal estimates, even set doses. But what this allows to do is incorporate that glucose level and add or even subtract insulin based on that glucose number. And so we expect this has been approved, but we expect it to be integrated into the device and rolled out sometime in 2024, hopefully the earlier part of the year. And so I think that was a pretty exciting innovation.
Absolutely. So let's look at number four, making sense of semaglutide in type 1 diabetes. Now, everyone who practices endocrinology, the majority of us are using semaglutide or tirzepatide or dulaglutide. We as often as we can get insurance to cover it. There's some other challenges with it. But let's talk about this case series. So it was not a study. And I need people to understand that this was not a study. This was a case series because they pulled specific people and did this with them specifically. One, newly diagnosed people with type 1 with residual C-peptide, so they're making their own insulin, but also that went on a lower carb diet. So understand what they did, but what are the results when they use semaglutide in those people? Prandial insulin, semaglutide can eliminate prandial insulin, eliminated the prandial insulin in those patients. If you think about it, semaglutide tells the pancreas to make insulin when glucose rises, and it can do that when you're still making when you're still making insulin. So it makes sense. So in early onset stage 3 type 1, the use of semaglutide demonstrated that. Basal insulin, it can eliminate basal insulin, but it didn't do it in all the patients. Again, high C-peptide and lower carbohydrate diet, most of the people were able to eliminate basal insulin. And then thirdly, the insulin requirement, treating newly diagnosed stage 3 type 1 patients with semaglutide reduced or eliminated the need for injected insulin. Please remember that type 1 diabetes is an autoimmune disease, and they followed these people and they wrote up this article, this letter to the editor, but eventually these people are going to need insulin. The questions around this become, how long are these people going to be able to be off of insulin or having on a reduced amount of insulin? Again, really exciting, really, really exciting, but coverage is going to be our biggest issue, because getting someone with type 1 diabetes covered for drugs like this is not easy.
Definitely. And our number 3 top episode was actually Time in Range as a Primary Glucose Metric with Julie Heverly, who is the director of the Time in Range Coalition at Diatribe. And we had the pleasure to interview her at the ADA Sci Sessions, where we actually interviewed several people as well. But I think this was an important episode to really hone in on the fact that we know there's so many limitations to A1C alone, that we're really trying to get the word out there about Time in Range, that it provides so much more of the full picture compared to just like one little dot on a map. This actually provides the way to get there. And I think when it comes to people with diabetes, which Julie herself has diabetes, she really advocates that this is so much more helpful. I know she's mentioned for her to understand her own diabetes, because this way you can see the true incidence of lows, of highs, of what's actually happening versus just getting this number saying you're a 7.5 today or you're a 6.5. Like, what does that really mean? And so this not only is used to really empower people with diabetes to really take control of their own health and see what's going on, but also for the whole healthcare team to do a better job of managing and seeing all the glucose variability that's occurring and making sure that we're really working to eliminate or reduce at least low glucose levels, reducing hypoglycemia and increasing that time in range. And I know you and I have had a lot of discussions throughout the year also about not just time in range, but also time in tighter range. And I think that's something we are going to see evolve over time. Historically, and up till this point, time in range has really represented 70 to 180. Of course, we're trying to maximize that, but with a goal of 70% for most people with diabetes, which is also motivating because we're not asking for perfection. We're trying to aim for 70%. But I think we're going to see movement towards that time in tighter range of 70 to 140, perhaps not with a goal of 70%, maybe with a goal of 50%. We'll see. But this is definitely an exciting area. And hopefully we'll also see more clinical trials adopting time in range instead of being so A1C centric.
And I think we'll hear more about this when you and I are at ATTD in March.
Lawrence.
Yes. So now let's do number two, the transition T2D study, where we interviewed Paloma Rodriguez and Kevin Pantalone from the Cleveland Clinic. And this was a great study, a poster that they did and presented at the ADA SCI sessions, where what they did was they looked at people with type 2 diabetes and who were on mealtime insulin and said, have we transitioned them to GLP-1 once weekly semaglutide. And the data was phenomenal. And I didn't, if someone had said to me, predict how many of the people on mealtime insulin could transition to GLP-1 and come off of mealtime insulin, my guess would have been 60, 70% maybe. And it was all but one person. All but one person came off of mealtime insulin altogether and was able to use a once weekly GLP-1. And I think the semaglutide specifically. And I think when we think about this clinically, we think, oh, that would be a great thing. But we also need to think about the burden. We talk about this a lot, the burden of diabetes and mealtime injections. It's not easy. And, you know, when you're giving someone with type 2, what do you say? Give 2 for a small, 4 for a medium, 8 for a large. If you're eating out, take 12. You know, you give them these kind of scaling and they have to guess and they have to bring it with them. And now it's Tuesday and they're out with their girlfriends for lunch and they forgot their mealtime insulin. What if I could take all that away? This data was impressive that we could do this. So it was first of all, they're both very dynamic people to talk to, but also that their data was so compelling that all but one person came off of their mealtime insulin. What it reminds us is we need to follow the guidelines. And the first injection should truly be a GLP-1. So none of these people should have been on mealtime insulin without a GLP-1 at first, if you think about the new guidelines. And so what they're doing now is looking backwards and saying, they're already on this, and don't look at this as clinical inertia. We missed our opportunity for GLP-1. No. There's never a missed opportunity. What you do is you go backwards and deprescribe mealtime and raise up that once weekly GLP-1. And what a phenomenal ability to reduce that person's burden and risk for hypoglycemia.
And I'm just going to chime in on that since it was done here and I was involved in the study. But one of the especially amazing things about it is that the way they were transitioned. So the mealtime insulin, it wasn't like cut in half. It was just stopped.
It
was just completely stopped as soon as that first dose of semaglutide 0.25 milligrams weekly was initiated. They were allowed to use a correction scale in case they needed it. Very few people actually needed it. And so I think in terms of a best practice, it shows us that is a way that we can likely transition people, which is a lot easier. One thing to keep in mind is their A1Cs were well managed. They were under 7.5 to start. So if you did have someone with an A1C of like 9 or 10%, it may look a little bit different. But at least in this trial that had those A1Cs under 7.5, some of them were on up to 120 units of insulin a day, quite a bit. And they were able to make that seamless transition. So I think that's very impactful for clinical practice.
And it makes it also, you know, we talk about that burden for the person, but you know, you think, okay, I got to stop this mealtime insulin. I'll cut it in half and then I'll do this. And then on Tuesday we'll have the nurse call and then no, just stop it. And what, you know, maybe their glucose is going to rise a little bit while you transition them, but the safest way to do it is actually absolutely stop the mealtime and then titrate the GLP-1 as quickly as you can within reason.
Yeah. All right. So are you guys ready for number one, Yay! The number one episode of 2023, which also happened to be like the first episode that we had put out this year. So this was actually about the iLet bionic pancreas. And we had the pleasure of interviewing Stephen Russell at the ADCS Technology Conference, which actually happened in December. But then the episode, I think, came out in January. So it was the first episode of the year. And so I think I'm so glad to see this was the top one, because this was really, when you think about innovations for this year, this really is a huge innovation. This is a pump that is like no other. It does not require any insulin settings. There's no basal rates. There's no carb ratios, correction factors, insulin action time, all those things we normally have to put in and think about. None of that is in there. Simply, you connect the person to the pump, you connect them to the CGM, and you swipe go bionic. And the pump learns the person. They don't carb count. They do meal estimates where they do usual, which most things should be usual, or less or more. So it's designed to really simplify all this kind of craziness with all the different calculations and the complexity that often has been associated with this technology is now really just thrown out the window. And it is designed to truly be simplistic. And I know now that we're seeing this was launched this year and it's available now for people to be able to use. And of course, recently now we saw that not just Dexcom G6, but now Dexcom G7 can be integrated into this too. It's really affecting practice and offering another very unique choice for people when they're deciding what pump to go with. I know particularly I'm seeing some people newly diagnosed with type 1 diabetes that are saying, oh, wow, there's an option. Like, I don't have to do strict carb counting and I don't have to do all this other stuff. Like, that sounds really appealing. And so I think this has just been unlike anything we've seen before. And again, this automated insulin delivery where the algorithm is learning essentially from the person, very unique system. And I also just want to comment that with the G7, I think that's particularly very important, the availability for this pump, because this pump must be connected to CGM for it to work. There are not backup settings. There is a backup mode where you can do some finger sticks temporarily so that it doesn't completely stop. But now with the G7, we've essentially eliminated that warm-up time. So you can put on a new sensor while the other sensor is still going, and your 30-minute warm-up now has become no warm-up. And so that will now eliminate, as long as someone has access to their supplies, that will eliminate any time where they're having to do finger sticks or you're not having optimal automation. And so, wow, what a year for them. And of course their data, when we talked to Stephen Russell, we talked a bit about the data that was published in New England. I feel like all of our articles we're talking about are in New England Journal of Medicine, but this was another one that was a pivotal clinical trial. And the results were very impressive. It was a randomized controlled trial and the reductions in A1C, as well as the improvements in time and range, were all statistically and clinically significant. So that is quite a practice changing paradigm of absolutely 2023.
Right. And they used people with higher A1Cs than were typically seen in other AID trials, which hats off to them to look at people, you know, to pull, you know, a lot of times they do trials and they say an A1C of at least 8, but less than 10 or 10 and a half. They had people with A1Cs above 14 in the trials. And that to me says everything about the company behind them to say, this isn't just for the person that could do a little bit better. This is for people with diabetes, and we respect and hats off to them for that.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. A lot of the criticisms of some of the clinical trials are that they include like the perfect patient that totally gets everything and is like, and then when you get to the real world, it be like, it's just different. But they did, they included a very diverse population, very real world population. So, all right. Well, I think that rounds out our top 10. What a year it's been.
Yes.
We've done like 5 million episodes this year. It's been so much fun. We hope that you will tune in because we've got lots more to come in 2024. So many exciting things. So thank you so much, everyone, for tuning in. And of course, we wish you happy holidays and a very happy new year.
Thank you.